Thanks. The audience is a little bit different, so I'll sort of perhaps put slightly different emphasis here and there. And I don't really want to take up an hour, so I'll sort of skip over a few things. People there are mostly not dynamicists, but the ones that are tend to think about planets, so they knew quite a bit about resonance and so on. But the main theme of the talk is stability and the general three-body problem. So I'm addressing the problem of you give me an arbitrary configuration, arbitrary masses, arbitrary everything, and I can tell you whether it's stable or not. It's a few I might get wrong with this, but mostly it's pretty right. And when I give talks about this, and some people here have heard me talk about this over the years, it's been a work in progress that I sort of dab a little paint on here and there, but it's finally ready to publish, and so I can actually give you an algorithm to use to decide whether any given configuration is stable. So I like to emphasise the importance of the three-body problem in astrophysics in particular. You know, what I mean is the stability problem is important on all length and mass scales. So, you know, from constructing planetary cores all the way up to perhaps, if there's time, colliding force collisions of galaxies. So, but of course the triple configurations aren't always just simple point mass systems, and it would be good if you could consider the question of stability in the presence of extra potentials and dissipation, if that's part of the story. And Rainer and I are actually looking at this problem with general relativity added in. So the stability criterion that I come up with is easily modified, as you'll see, to include extra potentials. So a stability criterion, an ideal stability criterion would be, well, if you're interested to see where it comes from, I mean, this criterion has no free parameters. It's from completely from first principles, and if you're interested in how it works, it would be nice if it was actually one could comprehend what was going on. I like to think that's what this is. It'd be nice if it worked for all initial conditions. And when I say all, there's always a little caveat on that. People who know the three-body problem know there are little islands, secret islands of stability and so on that you might get that wouldn't be picked up by this sort of general... Well, actually, in all generality, you can pick up all the little pockets. But anyway, I'll keep going. And a nice feature of this is that it's expressible in terms of the orbital parameters. So you want to be, and in particular, we'll look at it from a hierarchy point of view. So you would specify the initial eccentricities of the inner and outer orbit and the ratio of semi-major axes and the mutual inclination and so on and so on. You want a nice expression in terms of those things, so and simple to use. And as I said, be good if you can.
So you're mentioning these pockets of stability and stuff. So in parameter space, the boundary between stable and unstable is, of course, fractal.
Well, when you say of course, it's actually not, and I'll say something about that later, and I would have said exactly the same thing. But I'm thinking of, for example, recently some people published a paper on, well, it's actually a secular problem, but they claimed that you could have like a chain, like an orbit linked to another orbit. I mean, a totally bizarre configuration. But they claimed that there were stable systems like this, but they didn't demonstrate it with a direct integration, which is, if I'd been the referee, I would have said, go on, prove it. So Dan Fabricchi at CFA couldn't resist trying to do this and managed to show that there is a little patch of parameter space around the, you know, with these orbital elements that they specified, they didn't specify the phases, of course, that actually works. So that's an example of a weird patch in parameter space. This formulation, as you'll see, is relies on the configuration being hierarchical. But having said that, well, and so, you know, you're not allowed to have orbit crosses. But for the masses that I'm considering here, which are, you know, sort of, well, not extreme, and I'll define what I mean by that. What was I going to say? Oh, yes. So any of those strange systems are almost certainly unstable anyway. So it kind of works by proxy for the ones that you're not addressing.
But presumably you can address this, but in your very definition of stability, you said will, there is also
okay.
can.
And that's related to what we're talking
will,
about.
It's will on what time scale?
All right. So oh, well, that's a related question. So, okay, this is called Lagrange stability. So I'm thinking about system. By unstable, I mean that one body will leave the system, will escape. So, of course, if you have extreme mass, for example, the restricted three-body problem, you can have these funny situations where you do have chaotic motion, but the massless particle is trapped and it doesn't escape. That's an example of a counterexample of what I'm talking about. However, I'm going to concentrate on, as I said, this is the general problem, so I'm sort of at the other end of, well, not really the other end. I'm away from the restricted problem generally. Yeah, I am and I'm not. I'll qualify all these things as I go along. So, but anyway, and actually, the really one I'm pinning down is chaos. So when I say I'm after systems that disintegrate, I'm actually really only after systems that exist that exhibit chaos. So
is it fair to say that for stellar triples where the masses are roughly comparable, if the system is unstable any reasonable definition,
it will lose a body precisely
quickly?
Yep. Oh, well, no, not necessarily disintegrate quickly, but it will lose a body. So you can have a system where the outer eccentricity is really high, it's very weakly interacting, it's quite wide at peri, and it'll take a long time to disintegrate.
Okay, but long times would still be predictable secular timescales as opposed to...
Well, it could take many, many, many secular timescales. Formally, it could take forever if you're epsilon less than one, if you're eccentricity.
That's what I'm trying to quantify. I mean, for planets, we know that things can be unstable, but you really have to wait a couple of times for anything to happen. Is that...
I know, that's...
Not,
okay.
Isn't it true that that's usually not the case for stellar triples?
But a lot of chaos in planetary systems is not the stuff...
Well, that's what I was referring to before, but... But, you can still have slow diffusion or slow random walkout if the outer eccentricity is really high, even for similar masses. Anyway.
It's been true that even for resonantly interacting triples, the distribution of times for resonant interactions like 1 over T or 1 over T squared, that formula goes up to infinity.
Yeah, it does.
But again, I said in practice, you know, that by my definition means...
Well, a sphere of...
Without concocting pathology...
No, you don't need pathology. A sphere finds super long-lived triples that are they're formally unstable, but because the outer eccentricity is so close to one and they're very wide at peri, they just hang around and hang around and really hang up the calculation.
Long by this... By the relevant timescale of an n-body simulation, it may not be that long, right?
Well, what's long, Sver?
Three.
What's long? See, proof that he's not listening. Concentrate, man.
Just telling you about that
spend a whole week just integrating three-body system, just three bodies. That's long.
this is with grape.
The question is how many of the unstable triples really have such a long time? I mean, as a, from the practical viewpoint, I think it is much more easy. Maybe
they're rare. They are rare.
After we have had a certain couple of examples.
Okay. Yeah. They're still a small patch of parameter space. So, I want to show you how this works. It's been an intractable problem. Well, I guess it was the concept of instability was first dreamt up by Poincaré, so I can't really claim it's as old as Newton, but it's certainly been a solution's been a long time coming. So I want to show you how I've done this, since it's such a special problem and has sort of stumped a lot of people. So I set it up as a hierarchy to start with, using hierarchical coordinates, so there's no approximation there, as you know, but you know we want to consider it as, well, consider systems that are weakly interacting pairs of binaries. I mean, I know you all know what I mean by that, but it's useful to think about the problem from the point of view of, you know, how close can you bring the third body before the inner and outer orbit can exchange significant energy. So the interaction potential, the planet people would call this thing the disturbing function, although people who think about the restricted three-body problem would call this the disturbing function, although this has the units of energy and their thing is energy per unit mass, since the body they're studying is massless. So I'll call it the interaction potential. And this is the thing that allows the two orbits to talk to each other and is responsible for the exchange of energy and angular momentum. So not surprisingly, it's the focus of the whole study. It contains all the information about whether or not a system can disintegrate. So, well, of course, there's lots of parameters in the system, and so far people really have only got studied the boundary numerically. So some people here have seen these little animations lots of times, but I never get sick of seeing them, so hopefully you won't. And what I want to show you is the contrast between the behaviour of a stable triple and an unstable triple, and especially, in particular, the energy exchange, energy and angular momentum exchange. So I'll set this going. Oops, yep. So the outer one comes through. You see I'm plotting, well, this is a direct integration, and I'm plotting the instantaneous orbits, and you see energy exchange as it comes through periastron. You see angular momentum exchange because some eccentricity is induced in the inner one, but it's all put back. So basically, there's effectively no energy exchanged, and as it happens, angular momentum in this system. It's an equal mass system. If the inner two bodies had different masses, you'd actually see a secular change in the eccentricity, but the energy exchange would still be effectively zero. In fact, you can show that it's not zero, but it's exponentially small. That is, at least for a non-resonant triple, and I'll say what I mean about that soon. So contrast that with an unstable triple. This time there's energy exchange, but it's not put back. So it's really obvious there's been energy exchange because the outer orbit has expanded. It could shrink, it could go the other way. But this ultimately, if I kept integrating this, the outer body would escape this system, leaving behind a much reduced in size, in semi-major axis, binary with a significant eccentricity. And this was mentioned a little bit earlier on today, there's no doubt that, and I think you mentioned Stefan looked at this problem for his thesis, but with some extra stuff in there, that sometimes these two, in some circumstances, these two can be forced together because, of course, stars have finite size.
So is there a precise way of distinguishing between the two things? So, I mean, the change in energy is exponentially small, but it's not zero. So the step in your random walking just gets very, very small. But is it basically always random walking?
No.
Is that the time scale becomes effectively infinitely long?
No.
Or there's something sharp?
Something. That's a perfect question for this talk. I want to show you the difference between this kind of system and the other kind of system. They're fundamentally different, and that's what makes this problem absolutely fundamentally beautiful, because it's, you know, what's nature doing having this sharp boundary between these two kinds of behaviour? If it wasn't that way, we would say formally all triples are unstable on some time scale. In fact, mathematically, nobody has been able to say for sure that what I would call a stable triple is stable forever, but my gut feeling, or more than gut feeling, my understanding of how it works is that stable triples are stable forever. However, if you have a fourth body or more bodies involved in the hierarchy, I don't think you can make that statement, because there's sort of more ways for energy to move around. Maybe it's still true, I don't know. So I wanted to show the people I was giving this talk to. I know lots of people have seen these results before, but I wanted to show them the answer in the back of the book. To show them, give them a reason to keep listening, basically, show them where we're going. So this is numerical data. So what I've done, each red dot, and all the dots you don't see in the white part, except up above 0.8, represents the outcome of a direct integration of a triple. So if a triple is unstable for the given initial conditions, so the given outer eccentricity and period ratio, frequency ratio, orbital frequency ratio, it scores a red dot. This is for an equal mass system. These are equal mass systems, and the initial inner eccentricity is zero. So we see this stability boundary, and actually the resolution, it could be better in that, but. And you might guess that there's some kind of fractal stuff going on at the edge, but actually there isn't, and I'll say something about that later if you can remind me to. All this white stuff in here, they're not stable systems, they're actually exchanges. And so, and the reason they're not marked with red is the following. The way I determine whether a system's unstable or not is I do an integration and then a kind of shadow orbit, or ghost orbit, that is a system that's almost identical except for the initial eccentricity or something, but differing by, in this case, 10 to minus 7 to start with. And I follow the semi-major axis, which is kind of the thing that changes the least, the inner semi-major axis. And if it diverges by more than X, if it differs by more than X after N orbits, and I usually take, for these similar mass systems, I usually just take a few hundred, but if I was doing something where there was a big secular cycle, I would take many more. If the semi-major axis is only, if they've separated only by the amount you'd expect, that is N times the initial difference, then it's deemed, so what did I say, if it does diverge by more than what you specify, it's deemed unstable. And this is quite robust. So you can vary the number of orbits you follow, you can vary the epsilon, the difference in the initial conditions, and you still see the same boundary. So it really is representing the unstable system. So these white bits, they're exchanges, and the thing is they happen so rapidly, they follow each other out. The quantity I'm following never differs by enough to be deemed unstable, but there's no doubt they're unstable. So it kind of gives you, it traces where the exchanges are.
Up there all the way to E equals 1.
Point 0.8. So I only did data. The data's only to 0.8. I should only plot it to 0.8.
It's unstable all the way up there, right?
But it is, yeah, sure. So, you know, it's sort of...
So the stability region is really what's below the envelope down and to the right.
This is the boundary that we're concentrating on. So, and then with the theory, which I'll outline for you after showing you the answer, these are the boundaries of what are called resonances. You see they occur at integer values of the orbital frequency ratio. And I'm going to use a thing called resonance overlap, a concept called resonance overlap, to pick out the boundary. So, for example, this one here, there's two sides to it, is the 10-to-1 resonance. Here's the 11-to-1 resonance. And the theory cell, the idea of the resonance overlap stability criterion says, that's not mine, it's a sort of old idea, says that where they cross over should correspond to where the stability boundary is. Now, we can see already that, well, first of all, I'll just say this is a single resonance, and then it starts to cross over and neighbouring resonances here. The resonance overlap stability criterion says that should be clear, and it's not. And, well, I can say something about that. The resonance overlap isn't working perfectly for similar mass systems, but on the other hand, it's easy to understand what's going on in there.
There are more resonances, right, than you've drawn.
Okay, so there's infinitely many resonances in between, but it turns out that what I call moderate mass systems, and I'll define it properly shortly, are governed by the N-to-1 resonances. So if I plotted, say, the N-to-2 resonances that sit in the middle, they get wide up here, and they're irrelevant. And that's the reason why the boundary's not fractal. On the other hand, if we were looking at planets, extreme mass ratio systems, pairs of planets, but if you have a planet and a binary, that's not what I would call an extreme mass ratio system. But if you have two planets, there's low mass planets, then the resonances in between play a really important role. And when you have super low mass bodies, pairs, then lots of resonances matter in between, and then you start to get all this structure. I mean, there's some kind of structure here, but it's not actually those resonances causing it. So, but my definition of moderate mass systems are those that are governed by N-to-1 resonances. So I'll sort of quickly run through how it's constructed, since it's... I use a spherical harmonic expansion of this interaction potential, and that's allowed me to really produce an expression in the end that for what we need is an expression for the resonance width, so that we can apply this overlap criterion. We can know where we can we know how wide they are as a function of all the orbital parameters. We can determine when overlap occurs, and then specify whether a system's unstable or not. So, you know, you get out your Jackson classical electrodynamics and look up spherical harmonics and write these down. The spherical harmonic expansion for one of these terms starts at L equals zero, but the L equals zero term is cancelled by this. Well, the L equals zero terms from that pair there is cancelled. There's no L equals one term, zero, and then we start at the quadrupole L equals two term. And generally, for all these problems, quadrupole and an octopole are all you really need. For these problems, actually, all we need is the L equals two terms, the quadrupole terms. To simplify it, although I can do general inclination, but just to show you how it all works, we'll take the two orbits to be coplanar, and so I'll take the spherical polar thetas to be pi on 2. And, planet people know these various orbital elements, the true anomaly and the longitude of our periastron. So I can write the spherical polar azimuthal angles in terms of those. Don't expect you to follow all the details, but the essence of it is what I want is an expression that's a simple function of all the orbital elements, and this is a way to get at it. So these spherical harmonics in the plane like that are just simple. You can just write them in terms of exponentials, and I separate out the inner orbit and the outer orbit. And, well, the Perrys come out like that. And I can expect, well, for a system that's near the stability boundary, they're almost periodic. I mean, these orbits are almost periodic. Almost no energy is exchanged, so that's true. And I can expand these expressions in Fourier series. So, you know, I'm getting more and more sums here. This is actually four sums, so it's L and M and an N prime for this combination and an N for this combination. But in the end, I throw out all but one of these terms and it contains the essence of what's going on. So we see gradually these different orbital elements are separating out. This thing's just a function of the masses, of the inner two masses. This is a function of the inner eccentricity and the outer eccentricity, and actually you can write down really simple expressions for the one that, for the terms that matter. But the most important part of this is this thing called the resonance angle. So what happens is you've got angles, you've got orientation angles, the longitudes of periastron, and you've got orbital phases. In the coplanar problem, that's all you've got, four angles. And this resonance angle is a linear combination of all these angles. And it turns out that only certain ones of these really matter to us, as I'll show. So it's the behaviour of these resonance angles which determines what goes on and whether or not significant energy is exchanged. The essence of it is that stable non-resonant, stable systems exchange no energy effectively, and unstable systems exchange a lot. They must. If the outer body escapes, it's got to extract a lot of energy from the inner. So somehow we've sort of got to capture that. So here's, we're still on the interaction potential. I throw out all those infinity of terms but one, and it contains what we need to do the analysis. So define N to be the nearest integer, the integer closest to the period ratio, the frequency ratio. So we keep that term associated with that N. There was an N prime associated with a Fourier expansion of the inner orbit. I just keep N prime equals 1. So these are the N to 1 resonances. And I keep L equals 2 and M equals 2, and that's all. So the quadrupole terms. So I only consider these resonance angles. So N to 1, these are the mean longitudes, but they're just another way of expressing the orbital phases, and these are the orientation angles. So it's the behaviour of these angles that govern the whole story. And I allow, well, I, that's how, I, as I said before, I define moderate mass ratio systems as those which are governed by the N to 1 resonances. So, and they turn out to be systems for which M2 on M1 is greater than 0.01 and similarly for M3. So, for example, a planetary system composed of two 10 Jupiter mass planets is governed by the N to 1 resonances. Or you can also have, well, as long as... if one of them's smaller than 0.01, as long as the other one's bigger than 0.05, it's okay. And you can. This includes having a massive body on the outside, so it's not. They're not really restricted to moderate mass ratios. But so you could have, you know, one solar mass, a peanut or a massless particle, and a massive, much more massive body on the outside, you know, 100 solar masses, 1,000, whatever you like.
Shouldn't there be also one condition that the system is initially in some crazy stable state? I mean, when you have very unstable equal mass ratio systems, I mean, they do not fall under this criterion, don't they?
No, because they would just be so far above the stability boundary, they get caught anyway.
But you don't even have, I mean, measure exits
I see what you mean. So you could have, these are really small. Okay, so that's another thing I have to be careful with that definition. So I guess, yeah, you...
I guess that's probably also not dominated by end-to-one resonances, but there you also have the chaotic behaviour that's exactly
But if you so Rainer means if you had, I think this is what you mean, if these masses were really small, much smaller, both of them, the pair, but you were way above the stability boundary, the end-to-one resonances would still be the ones that crossed, actually. I think you're right. So we'll think about near the boundary. This is what, yeah. Okay, and just a quick look at what those eccentricity functions look like. You can do a Taylor series. The inner eccentricity one, there's only one of them, so you only need to know one function. And actually, this simple Taylor series is quite accurate for all eccentricities of interest. So that's all right. But you don't want to have n Taylor series for the outer eccentricity function, and actually can work out this asymptotic expression, which is very similar to what Douglas Heggie has done for hyperbolic interactions, and we see the exponential dependence on so n. Remember, n effectively is the period ratio or the frequency ratio. This is what the outer eccentricity functions look like. The solid line is exact in the sense of doing a numerical integration. And the dashed lines are this asymptotic expression. So that's for n equals 5 and n equals 20. And so the higher the n, the higher the peak falls over higher eccentricity. Just a word about energy exchange, which we can relate to change in orbital frequency and semi-major axis. This expression is familiar to people familiar with Lagrange's planetary equations, but in fact it's a misnomer that it's planetary because you don't have to, it says nothing about the masses. You can apply it to any, use it for any interaction potential. One can show, and this is again a Heggie result, except that Douglas Heggie, as I said, looked at hyperbolic flybys and the energy exchanged. This is for bound systems, but you can show that it's a similar thing. It involves things called overlap integrals, a concept from quantum mechanics. And so we can see from this that this is consistent with the idea that on average no energy is exchanged between the inner and the outer orbit when the frequency ratio is large. So sigma is just shorthand for frequency ratio.
But so far there's nothing here about a qualitative difference.
No, we're getting there.
Okay.
So almost there. Now, there's intermediate kinds of systems when we're getting close to the stability boundary, and we can really see these. It's much easier to we see more extreme examples of this for extreme mass ratio systems. For example, there are several systems now, planetary systems now known, which that are resonant. In particular, they're 2-to-1 resonant systems. GJ876 is, I think, the first one discovered, and they involve, well, so the orbital periods are in ratio, near ratio 2-to-1, and such systems exchange significant energy. So I said before that no energy is exchanged effectively in a stable system. However, here's a stable system exchanging energy, And we're getting closer to what Fred wants me to say. He knows the answer, but he's waiting patiently. So here we have, this is the inner semi-major axis plotted against the number of outer orbits, or time, proxy for time. And each squiggle is associated with one outer orbital passage. And we see this slow change in the semi-major axis. Energy is actually being exchanged. We can also plot the period ratio against this thing, the resonance angle for this system. So we see these here are the orbital phases, the mean longitudes, the inner mean longitude and the outer, and we see that there are this ratio 2:1, and this, actually that should be a pomiga, that's a longitude of the inner periastron. But anyway, the main thing to notice here is that this angle librates for, well, here's three different systems. This one in here is the actual system, well, as given the orbital parameters the observers tell us. So this real system has this combination of these orbital angles librating between two values very close to 0 degrees. I've done another example a bit further out. Still we have libration of that angle, and this is really important for the whole story and the essence of what Fred's after. And starting at a little bit further away from exact resonance, we see that instead of libration we get circulation of this resonance angle. So it turns out that the resonance angle satisfies approximately a pendulum equation. Pendulums exhibit these two different kinds of behaviour, libration and circulation. And what's crucial to this story is the separatrix, the curve in phase space or parameter space that separates these two kinds of behaviour. So that's a stable resonant system, and it's much harder to find stable resonant systems for similar mass systems, although we do find them. Here's an unstable triple, again plotting the semi-major axis against time, but this time we see a big change in the semi-major axis, this is the inner one, and of course it follows a random walk, and most people here are familiar with that kind of behaviour. And here's a system started with almost the same initial conditions behaving differently. And that's the kind of behaviour that I'm capturing when I make a decision about whether a system's stable or not. I monitor that quantity. Well, just a quick word about weakly interacting systems. So the triples are examples of weakly interacting systems. So you have one sub-part of the system and another part, they have their own personal set of frequencies, and when you allow these two parts to interact, they can exchange energy. And so all such systems you can express in this way. You have a linear combination of all the phases, all the angles in the system, and hence all the frequencies in the system. And it's when this combination of angles varies slowly that you actually have a resonance. The key thing is that each of these resonance angles satisfies a pendulum equation. And we know, we've all studied pendulums. As well, the hierarchical triples are examples of this, each with their own set of frequencies and angles. And hence the resonance angles. Oh, well, I'll come back to the pendulum. Well, that's a bit about the history. I guess I really want to move on. All these papers are absolute essence of beauty. Poincaré's three-volume set that many of you will be familiar with, that he essentially invented the theory of dynamical systems and chaos theory, without calling it chaos theory. Famous CAM theorem is intimately related to this. Fermi-Pastorulam's problem of studying a series of nonlinear interacting springs and seeing how the energy moves around in it, and so on and so on. Chirikov is usually credited with this idea of resonance overlap, but actually it's these boys that first notice that if you have weakly interacting conservative systems, Hamiltonian systems, they notice that if resonances overlapped in some sense, then it was a predictor of instability. So the key to it, well, we want to be able to say when a resonance angle librates and when it circulates, because, well, I haven't defined a resonance. Let me go ahead and I'll just get my pendulum theory here. One can, if you have an equation for a pendulum, you can work out the separatrix. And a resonance is defined to be when, well, I think I said that before, when a resonance angle librates. And so what we're really interested in is the dividing curve between libration and circulation, and that's the separatrix. And the resonance width is defined to be half the distance between the maxima of the separatrix. So that's the width of a resonance. And so what we really want to do is be able to write down a pendulum equation for our resonance angles, because once we have that, we can work out the resonance width. So you write down your resonance angle of interest and its derivatives. You can write the derivatives in terms of the rates of change of the frequencies, which you can write in terms of the Lagrange, using the Lagrange planetary equation. You can use the interaction potential to work out exactly what these derivatives are, and to cut a long story short, you can derive a pendulum equation for each resonance angle, and all the information you're interested in lives inside this coefficient that contains all the information about the orbit, so the eccentricities and the masses. These things are just simple functions of M1, M2 and M3, so you know how. If you know this, and you know how to write down the separatrix, you know how to write down a resonance width, and you know what it is by this in terms of the orbital parameters, and all those functions are just simple high school functions. So if you do that, this is not a real one, but if you plot out this for equal masses, the 10-to-1 resonance, for example, the theory says that if you're a system inside with initial conditions inside this green part, it says that angle, the 10-to-1, the resonance angle should librate. And resonance overlap says that if you're a system with initial conditions that lie inside any of these overlapping parts, it predicts that your system should be unstable. So let's just see how well that works. If we just take it as it is and try and do that, we see that it doesn't work very well. So here's the resonance boundary, and overlap is happening a fair bit above that. And the ingredient that's missing, it turns out, this doesn't matter for the restricted problem, but for the general problem it does. You need to know how much eccentricity is induced during one outer orbital passage. Or if there's secular variation in your eccentricity, and that happens in an extreme way if you're... It can happen in an extreme way if your orbits are inclined or if your mass ratios are extreme. You have to take into account the maximum of a secular cycle. But anyway, that's it's easy to write down. Well, the expressions for the induced eccentricity are simple in themselves. And if you use that eccentricity, the inner eccentricity, in your expression for the resonance widths, you can get these crossover points pretty well. So there's that one we saw before for equal masses. I'll just show you some results and then I'll stop. There's an example of two 10 Jupiter mass planets with an inner eccentricity of 0.5, and we see that it's getting the crossover pretty well. Every second one, the even resonances are clear pretty much, as they should be according to the theory, but the odd ones are filled in. And that's because, it turns out, and one can work through it, it's fairly simple to show, that systems in here, the resonance angle is starting near the separatrix rather than in the centre of the resonance. There's one for unequal inner masses, but M31 circular to start with. Again, we're getting quite a bit of leakage coming down in here, but it's kind of picking up the boundary fairly well. There's one with a small body on the outside and equal masses on the inside, some initial eccentricity. And again, we're seeing for these initial conditions that the even resonances are more or less clear and the odd resonances are filled in. There's one with a heavy body on the outside. And this is the last one in this set. Just to show you what happens if you change the orientation, it picks up that. Well, one can understand the difference, let's just see. This one, they're aligned, and the even resonances are clear and the odd resonances are filled. And if you rotate the orbits to start with 390 degrees, the odd ones are clear and the even ones are filled, and it's easy to see why with the theory behind it. And finally, a stability algorithm, a simple stability algorithm to use to determine whether any given triple is stable or not, using this idea of resonance overlap. So basically, you just determine the relevant N, and in fact just choose the nearest lowest N. Calculate the distance from exact resonance, so the difference between your frequency ratio and that N, and you calculate this thing that's kind of like a pendulum energy, which is such that if the associated resonance angle is librating, this thing will be negative, and if it's positive, if it's circulating, it'll be positive. A system is in a resonance if this thing is negative, basically, that says that the resonance angle is librating. So if you calculate this number and the associated number for N plus 1 and you find they're both negative, you can say the system is unstable. That's it. That's all you have to do. So it's not one single... It's almost one single formula, but you just have to calculate these numbers. And there's a routine you can have if you want it. And it just spits out one number, 0 or 1. You put in all the orbital parameters and it'll tell you whether it's stable or not. And here is what you get.
When you say you calculate the nearest resonance, the mathematical symbol you had there was for the floor. Is it actually
the floor? It's the floor.
The floor.
The floor, yeah. Because you're going to do N and N plus 1. So you want to be in between those two. And here is how good or otherwise it works. So here's real data, like I showed you before, without any resonances overlaid. And here's the stability algorithm. So I've just generated the dots in this just by running through all the initial conditions on this rectangle and seeing whether a blue dot corresponds to it spitting out a 1 rather than a 0. So it does pretty well with that and gets some structure. And here is another set of data, but this time I've plotted the outer periastron distance against the outer eccentricity, so the outer peri in units of the inner semi. This is in some sense more intuitive because it tells you how close you come outer periastron. And you see this structure, the resonance structure there, these dots correspond to the points where those neighbouring resonances overlap. You see them bunching up for higher eccentricity. And here is the stability algorithm getting some of the structure, missing out on these points up here. They're the points corresponding to where the stability data leaks into the resonances, if you like. So I would say if you really want to know whether a system's stable and you can see whether you're near the stability boundary, that's easy to do, you should just go and integrate the system and see what the answer is. But if you want to do some statistical study or you want to do lots and know the stability of lots and lots of systems, run through parameter space and get a feel for whatever it is you're studying, I think this stability criterion is very useful. But I think it's even more useful, the whole theory is useful for seeing how what's going on inside a triple and how energy and angular momentum move around. I mean, there's a lot more to it than just this stability stuff that I've developed that allows you to study lifetimes of decaying triples and how energy and angular momentum are exchanged and so on. But anyway, I'll finish there.
Planning. 2 minutes for questions.
Yeah. No more questions.
I don't know, it will be a quick and not quick question. So I'm just interested, by ruling out hierarchically unstable triples, I'm just interested how many interesting systems we lose. So we say that this triple is hierarchically unstable. So what we do normally is in so-called Monte Carlo simulations, we just don't keep any attention to that. But if it's chaotic system or something else, then interesting stuff could happen. So I'm just curious, how many hierarchical triple could be missed out by the criterion of stability, and we're just losing a lot of interesting...
Oh, so you mean how many does it get wrong, do you think? Is that what you mean? Or?
No, she's saying how many, once you decide that they're unstable, and you just somehow get rid of them, aren't you missing interesting things that might be happening as they disintegrate?
How many hierarchical triples stables in general compared to just Oros triples?
Oh, well, it's a really broad question. I mean, if you're asking, in a cluster, in a real cluster, what fraction of all triples that are ever made are unstable? Well, that's a question that you can, depends on what triples you make. for example, this stability criterion is in the n-body codes of spheres. And basically, its most important use there is to not hang up the code. So you can decide if something's stable. If this tells you it's stable, then you don't have to fiddle around integrating it. The time step is governed by the shortest orbital period in there. So that's a practical use for it.
I understand the bottleneck.
Yeah, well, what? So, I mean, that's a use for it. I mean, I don't really understand your question, I guess, because...
Well, there are systems, I'll speak a bit in my talk, which could not be produced from hierarchical triple systems and by observed.
Could not be produced by hierarchical triples, so... give us an example.
Okay, it will be very much going into my talk.
Okay, all right.
But I just was curious how many hierarchical stable to hierarchical unstable.
To give the opposite example, maybe this helps to clarify. I mean, we have in the Monte Carlo simulation, we have those three-body encounters. So there we use it in the opposite sense, and we find the triple is stable, we terminate the integration, and otherwise we have still to go on. So it doesn't mean that.
Oh, you don't throw it away?
No.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, no, then it's integrated, and then you see what happens.
No, but Reiner, in your Monte Carlo, do you actually preserve the triple's properties for later use?
Actually, we are looking at them, but we have not yet finished the process to store them again as a Monte Carlo object to be considered for the next encounter.
Course,
we have a triple binary encounter, and that's actually what
the in-body code does, though.
But what is there is already, there's already some algorithm where we look how many triples are there and whether they are stable according to...
But I think that's what Natasha's talking about. So right now what you probably do is you break the triple, right?
Yeah, we break a triple, but this is just 10 to 11.
That's the thing.
They're both kept. So the stable triple's there, and if it's, it has an interaction later on, then it's sort of woken up. And
not stable,
and
yes, but unstable.
The unstable ones are integrated until they disintegrate.
If you break a triple, then it is stable. You didn't understand me properly, because right now we don't have any method to deal with stable triples.
Yeah,
when it's unstable, we continue, and we continue again, and again, and again. And certainly there is somewhere a limit for crazy behavior if we have too many millions of steps, and we have a terribly unstable triple which somehow doesn't want to dissolve, then at some stage we terminate it also. Yeah? But this is second order. I mean, the first thing is, when it's unstable, we continue to look to
integrate. That's what she
does. Yeah, sure. I mean,
there's a further refinement. These things are stable in isolation, but the clusters are not isolated. So you have secular perturbations.
Yeah, but it's already second order after
the decay. No, but this drives the decay of one of those triples.
But the antibody people are going to secular state too. By nature of their
integration.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe this, we don't want to miss the cookies, but this is the time to ask this question. So in the current direct n-body codes, when you form a triple, how exactly do you continue treating that triple dynamically in your integration?
I think this will be a subject for session next week.
Well, just quickly answer.
Briefly, do you make any approximation? Do you decouple the two orbits at all? Or do you fully integrate without any approximation?
In the boundary, in the center mass approximation, so it becomes a two-body problem. Unless there's a quasi cycle with a high eccentricity, then we do averaging.
And you calculate the quasi cycles from analytic perturbation.
Averaging,
he integrates the rates of change of the elements.
You also assume some stability or instability because you don't really do a full integration for all three bodies through. Right.
Well, so you can do it if you can switch this off, then it becomes very tedious.
The things that people use to call the terrible triples, the ones you would integrate fully and they would spend weeks on, that's all you were doing, those you've kind of you regularize them out in some way. And so you may be missing at least some of the subtle effects like quasi cycles that might be.
No, he has the, he
we
integrates
know,
the.
You know what the maximum is, and immediately
quasi in isolation.
Exactly.
Sure,
so, you know, the kinds of quasi cycles that are affected by, you know, phase shifts from distant flybys, all kinds of things, this is not really in there.
Well, yes, it is, because they're checked every outer orbit. That's what you said. So you're integrating the rates of change of the inner orbital elements and integrating directly the outer orbit. Is this right, Sverre? This is what you were telling me the other day.
We checked for stability, but I can't remember whether we checked for
quasi. And every outer orbit, it's checked for perturbations and stability.
And you reevaluate what would be the next quasi cycle.
So you save. Yeah, so you're saving the.
What do you do for stellar evolution?
You do it as you're going to fly, as you go along.
No, but
you don't know how to do it, right?
Yes, you do that the same way as you for a binary or for a single.
But
consistently in time.
But it acts like it's just inner binary without a third.
So the inner binary is treated as a single object somehow as if you had binary evolution.
Yeah. You have binaries.
It is updated. If it is a Roche, you just triple to the end. Then you terminate the triple and do it
somehow according to some recipe.
That's just the Roche. The other
reason you terminate the triple, you just do it directly.
But always the stars are evolving, and on a much longer time scale normally than the secular time scale.
Hey, we should go grab the cookies before.